first book. It's called Joe Pardo's 31 Life-Changing Concepts, and it's a self-development book designed for people who hate reading books. So I filled it with lots of my own hand-drawn artwork. In order to make this launch a success, I need your help. Go to howtodream.co/book to get all the instructions. I really appreciate your help in advance, and I really would love to make this launch a success. So again, go to howtodream.co/book for all the details how you can get involved and help. The book will be free for the first 5 days. I hope you all have a magical day.
This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Hey, dreamers, I'm Joe Pardo, and today I'm talking with Paul Coliani. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's great.
Awesome. I should get it right. It's Italian, right?
Are you Italian?
Pardo? Yes, I am. I'm Italian.
All right. Good to know.
It was originally, I think it was like Pardi or something like that when my grandfather came over, or great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather came over the boat. I should know the story, but...
Well, that's funny. My name is actually two names, Cola and Iani. I didn't know that for the longest time, and then I found out, oh, two families got together. Coliani, I get it.
It's pretty neat. Didn't hyphenate it.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad they didn't.
Well, Paul is making his dreams come true by hosting a personal growth podcast called The Overwhelmed Brain, blogging, and writing ebooks, hoping to afford his next pack of ramen noodles.
That's correct.
It's the life of an entrepreneur, right? It's a tough one.
No, you got it.
It's not for the faint of heart, that's for sure.
I don't eat ramen noodles, but I like how that's worded because it does seem that way sometimes.
Well, you know, it's funny. I do like ramen noodles.
Do you?
I don't eat them very often, but I do. You know, I don't mind a pack now and then.
Well, they're tasty.
I'm glad to have you on the show, Paul.
Well, great to be here. It's good to meet you too, because I think we met online a few weeks ago, and then we just connected, and you said, "Hey, come on the show." So I'm like, "All right, let's check this out."
Yeah, I'm glad that you thought enough of the show and me to want to come on, and that's awesome.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm honored.
Oh, I'm honored to have you here. So why don't we get started by giving some background about yourself? I know that there is a ton of information about you on your about page, probably more information than I would get out of most, even my own about page. But, you know, it really was breaking my heart when I was reading it. So I would love for you to go in and talk about your journey, you know, your background up till this point.
Wow. The journey actually began, as all journeys begin, at childhood, when I grew up with a great family. However, there was one aspect of the family, my stepfather, who was an alcoholic and still is to this day. When I was a child, I grew up with learning these coping mechanisms, these survival skills. So when I finally moved out of the house, out of this abusive situation, it wasn't really physically abusive to me, but to others it was. When I finally moved out of this situation, I took these coping and survival skills from childhood into the adult world. And I became, like a lot of adult children of alcoholics, I became super responsible and really judgmental. And I had all these weird behaviors that I took into the world. So when I started my work life, I just became an excellent worker, but a lousy person in relationships. Because when you have all these behaviors that you bring in from a dysfunctional relationship, you figure out how to live in the world with these childhood beliefs. So growing up, I would always do great at work until I got burnt out. I usually had a 4-year burnout point. And then in relationships, I would do great in relationships until they realized how judgmental I was, and then they would leave me. So I would leave every job to go to a new job, and then my relationships would end by them leaving me. So it was an odd combination of me leaving work and my girlfriend's leaving me throughout life. It's a whole sordid history here, but basically that's what happened to me, is that I grew up in an alcoholic household, had a lot of jobs throughout the years, and then finally, just a few years ago, decided to take the reins of my life. So that there's a lot of variety in my life until I said, you know what? There's something wrong with my life here. I got to fix this. So up to this point, I've had a lot of things happening, a lot of different jobs, a lot of different relationships. Well, not a lot, but enough to go, whoa, there's something wrong here. So I need to change something. That's where I'm at today.
You know, it's amazing that you found yourself in a situation where you actually were able to self-recognize your own problem and then try to make a fix, but not even just make a fix, but eventually find yourself on a path of blogging and sharing your experience and trying to help people all around the world fix their, I guess, depression.
Mm-hmm. Not only depression, you know, anything they're going through. I think what happens with people is that they hang on, like I said, these childhood beliefs, they hang on to these feelings and emotions they developed as children and maybe weren't able to express as children. They hang on to them. And when you hang on to that stuff without expressing them, then you become and do dysfunctional things. You have dysfunctional behavior. You play head games and you don't even mean to. You don't even want to play head games, but you just end up doing it because you have all these strange belief systems, strange philosophies in your head. So yeah, there's a point where you look at your life and go, why does this keep happening to me? You know, why do women keep leaving me, or men, whatever relationship you're in? Why do these people keep leaving me? You know, you look at the common denominator and you go, okay, there's something wrong here. So the story you read on my website was, two stories. I had a 13-year relationship and she left, and that put me into a bout of a 2-year depression. And then I thought I was okay. And I got into a marriage with another woman and she left. And I was like, wait a minute, marriage is supposed to be forever. You're not supposed to, you know, stop marriage. You're supposed to keep going. So after she left, I really had a light bulb turn on going, wow, there's something I need to change here. That was the turning point. So yeah, you look at your life and you go, all right, why does this keep happening to me? I need to change something. So that's what happens. Your self-reflection kicks in.
So at what point did you start up the blog to talk about these issues?
Oh, 2013, around June. So it was a point where I was still working in computers and technology. I was working at the hospital. There was a point at that time where I decided to start talking about all this stuff I've gone through and also help others who have gone through it. Because I'm the kind of guy that people would stop at work and go, hey, I got this problem. It'll be a personal problem. And I would say, well, let's talk about it. And we'd talk about it. And like 2 or 3 hours later, we stayed late after work talking about this. And I realized that people are really resonating with what I've gone through and what I've learned in life. So I decided to start sharing that with the world.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel the same way. It's one of the reasons how I got to this show.
Oh, really?
Oh, definitely. Talking to people and answering, you know, tough questions. I mean, I still get phone calls all the time from my friends looking for advice and stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't see myself as somebody who has lived an extraordinary, you know, I'm not the most interesting person in the world.
Yeah, but we all have something to share, don't we?
No, that's true. I guess what it comes down to is it's not just the fact that like you experienced it, but you understand how to put it into words and explain it in a way that people can resonate with it.
Well, I think also a lot of people aren't willing to be vulnerable, where I said, you know what, I'm going to be vulnerable, because by doing that, you're able to relate. I mean, just you reading my story going, you know, whatever, you're resonating with it in some way. And you're going, wow, I can relate to this. And when you allow yourself to be vulnerable to the world opens up to you and starts to trust you and says, you know what, I want to tell you my story. Like I've had people walk up to me when I was working at the hospital. I had people walk up to me and just start telling me their life story just from a couple words. And they're like, wow. And then I'd be with coworkers, and they'd be like, do you know that person? I'd be like, no. Why did they tell you all that? And I'm like, I don't know. But it's because I don't mind telling others the hard stuff. I don't mind telling others the stuff I'm embarrassed about, I'm ashamed about, I feel guilty about. I just let it all out. And that's what I do on my show. I just put it all out on the table. And if you want to judge me, go ahead and judge me. And what I found is that people really don't end up judging you. What they end up doing is having compassion for you. Like, wow, you went through that? Then they relate to you, because like, we all have our own issues. We've all dealt with our own dysfunction, and people that we've had in our lives, we've had to deal with. We've all had this stuff. So I think it just resonates with a lot of people.
You know, I think when you look at people who make it big in or, you know, quote unquote famous or what have you, the thing is they're all vulnerable, right? They're all like, you're either on stage or you're in front of people like that. That's a level of vulnerability. And you know, it's funny that you were saying the story about being in a hospital and someone just, you know, starts talking to you. I get the same exact thing. I had a girlfriend once get into an argument with me at we were in the middle of a store down in Florida, and she's like, are you just going to talk to everyone? Like, cause I was record shopping, and the guy next to me and I were looking at some of the records, and we're like, spark up a conversation. And then I'm like, I can't believe you're yelling at me for having a conversation with somebody. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just who I am. Like, you know what it is? Strangers are our best friends you haven't met yet.
Yeah.
You know, obviously not in every case, but in most cases I would have found it to be true. And I really just enjoy meeting new people and hearing stories. And I feel like it's like going to school every time I get to hear another story from someone.
Do you consider yourself an extrovert, or?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I have extroverted tendencies, but just as much as I have introvert, I guess I'm just normal.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
The rest of us aren't.
Well, I don't think I don't sway one way or the other. I mean,
no, I get that.
What about you? I mean, would you consider yourself an extrovert?
Oh, here's the question you ask yourself if you care to go this way. When you need time to like get away from it all or recharge your batteries, do you like to be with people or not?
I always want to be with people.
You're more extrovert. You're more extrovert. Yeah, that's what extrovert is. Me, when I need to get away from it all and just need a break, I need to be away from people. I need to be alone. I need to recharge. I need to be alone. So I'm more introverted with extrovert tendencies.
So I guess I would be extroverted with shyness or introverted tendencies?
You know, a label's a label. It probably doesn't really apply to everybody in every situation. But I would consider you more extroverted for sure. And, you know, we all want to be alone at some time. I mean, we all want to shut the bathroom door and be by ourselves at some point. So we all have every aspect within us. It's just, I was just curious what you considered yourself as. Because usually people who like to talk to other people, pick up, you know, start conversations with other people, had the extrovert in them. Now, your girlfriend, I wonder if she was more introverted and she made her uncomfortable that you talked to everyone.
Definitely was introverted. But, you know, it's funny, we bring up this concept because I don't have a problem being in front of a group of people or a bunch of people. But, you know, I do try to shy, and maybe you have a label for this.
I try not to label.
I know, me too. I hate labels. That's one of the things in my book is screw labels.
Good. I like it.
But, you know, it's like, I hate when I'm in a group, and I shouldn't use the word hate. I know that's like super negative, but I, when I'm in a group of people and somebody just feels like they have to dominate the whole group in the submission. And it's not just like, oh, I got to talk about me, but it's like they just, like somebody appointed them in charge of like everything. And it's like, well, yeah, but what if, you know, asking other people what they want to do, or, you know, ask, you know, having questions at the same time of, instead of just, you know, telling.
Oh, like a quote leader who does not listen to other people and just leads, or.
But I think that's a boss.
Well,
versus a leader.
I was just talking about that yesterday with someone. The sign of a good leader is one who lets the team take all the credit. When you're a leader who decides to take the reins and do all the work, or at least make it appear that you're the one in charge and you're the one accountable and responsible for everything that goes on. I mean, you ultimately are, but when you take the credit for all that, that's not a leader. That's someone who needs attention. It's an attention monger. So I think that's who you're talking about.
You know what? That's it. Well, mongers is a little more politically correct word, I think.
What'd you call it?
Maybe attention whore or something to that effect.
Good point.
I don't know why I couldn't think of that myself.
No, I get that. I've been in situations where people have dominated a conversation, and my sister's ex-boyfriend, when I was living at home and a long time ago when I was like 16, he would not shut up. He just would not shut up. It would be like 12 at night and he'd be talking to me and I'd be like, I'm getting tired. I got to go to bed. And he goes, oh, you got to go to bed? Well, let me tell you about this. And he just keep talking and talking and talking and be like, I don't understand. Can't you read my signals? I'm ready to leave this conversation.
Where's the off switch?
I know. So I get it.
Oh man. Yeah. It can definitely be difficult to deal with. I mean, what's some of the best ways you've dealt with that?
It depends on the person for sure. But if I'm in a situation where someone is talking and talking and talking, what I'll typically do is if I don't have anything else to do, I'll let them talk. In fact, this is opposite of what most people will do. I'll purposefully let them talk until they're so exhausted and out of resourceful things to talk about that they won't talk anymore. So the conversation could literally last 2 hours. But what has happened to me when I do this, it's great, is if you have the time and you want to try this, if you have the time, just let them talk and just ask for more and say, oh, really? What else? Oh my God, tell me more. And you keep doing that. And what ends up happening is they finally run out of steam. And then they go, well, you know, I got to go. But that's not the magic part. The magic part is the next time they see you, they don't want to be near you.
I never had that happen before.
Well, because we never usually let people talk. We're like, oh, you know, I got to go. You know, my sister's waiting for me or whatever. But instead, let them talk. It doesn't happen all the time. But a lot of the times what will happen is that they will feel a little uncomfortable being with you because they're not used to those responses. They're used to people going, oh, you know, I got to go. They're used to dominating the conversation, and that gives them maybe a level of control or a level of whatever. But when you say, oh, yeah, tell me more. I love this. Oh, go on. What else you got? They're like, oh, you know, I think I've run out of things to say. They won't say that. And then the next time they see you, they probably will avoid you because they don't want to be in a situation where they're now uncomfortable, because it's uncomfortable to keep talking and talking, come up with things to say. The responses they're used to, they're not getting from you. So it changes their dynamic. If they're used to talking and people going, oh, you know, this isn't great, but I got to go, making people uncomfortable, then they're in charge. But when you go, oh, yeah, continue, you're in charge. You're actually leading them. So that's a neat way to deal with it if you're ever in that situation.
You know, it's funny. I generally try to do the same thing because I'm just like, I have a high tolerance for I don't want to say pain, but I have a high tolerance for being, you know, listening and responding and stuff like that. Unless I'm like really tired, then it's just like, man, I hope they don't ask me any questions about what they're saying.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, as soon as they start going, what do you think about that? And then you're like, wow, I'm really not interested in this conversation at all. What do I think about it? I never thought about it. You know, it's one of those things where you do have to kind of honor yourself and you're like, how do you be diplomatic at the same time honoring yourself? You want to say, you know, this, I have no clue about what you're talking about, or I'm not interested. I mean, how can you tell someone that? Like, I'm not interested in what you're talking about. I don't know if you remember that old Saturday Night Live skit with Michael Myers where he plays this German. It's called Sprockets. And he goes, your conversation has become tiresome. And then he just turns his head. It's like, I just want to be able to do that. Just say, oh, this conversation has become tiresome. And then just walk away. It's a good feeling if you can have that level of honoring yourself. But most people will try to keep the peace and say, oh, yeah, go on. Oh, okay. Uh-huh. And they're looking at their watch and their feet are starting to point towards the door and they're trying to walk away. But they, you know, they're respectful. But really it does come down to, you know, I can't stand here and talk all day, so I got to go. And it doesn't, you don't have to lie. You can just say, I can't stand here and talk all day. That's the truth.
I hate telling people that.
Really?
I do because I want to, you know, a lot of times I do necessarily want to hear the stories. You know what? The point of me not wanting to hear the stories is when I realize when that glimpse of they don't really care what I think. Like they're talking and they might stop and ask me what I think, but mm-hmm. like I'm seeing right through that. Like it doesn't matter what I say. They're not listening to They're not listening to respond. They're listening to talk more. They're not listening. They're just waiting to respond. I think that's it. I'm probably butchering it, but something like that.
Yeah, that's hard. You know, when you get in a situation where someone's talking and talking and talking, and you want to be kind and respectful, first of all, you do have to realize that they're not being too kind about your time. So first of all, they're not giving you, you know, is this okay? Can we talk more? Of course, they're not thinking. They're more self-centered in a way. Not everyone's like that. A lot of people talk a lot. My girlfriend says I talk a lot, and I don't see it, but apparently I do, and I have to reel myself in every now and then. That's a tough situation. I haven't really thought about that too much because I don't think I invite that too much into my life. See, there's a level of building rapport. There's ways to break rapport, and there's ways to build rapport. And you found ways to build rapport. You're in the record store. You're talking to people, and you have common interests, so you're building rapport. And then the ways to break rapport, there's several. Like if someone talks like, hey, how you doing? And you go, hey, how you doing? You're on the same level. It's like that same frequency of voice and speed and pace. So you're just kind of on that lower level. But if they're really high input people, like, hey, I got this idea and I got these great ideas. And you go, oh my God, that sounds great. Tell me all about it. You're still building rapport. But if you do the opposite of what they're doing, like, hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing? What's going on, man? Then you start breaking the rapport. It's a rapport building or a breaking process. So there are ways to get them uncomfortable around you. So if somebody is continuing to talk to you, you can talk maybe slower and slower. Or faster and faster and talk about more subjects than them until they're sick of you. The true way out of this, the most honorable way, is just to be honest. Like, you know, I really have no interest in this subject, but you know, I'm sorry, I gotta go. I mean, because you're honoring yourself. But a lot of people won't do that because they want to keep the peace with people and they have to see these people again and again. Maybe it's a coworker or whatever. So you'd find other ways to break that rapport, because obviously they believe they're in rapport with you and they believe that you're in rapport with them. But so there are ways to do it. And that's one of them.
I thought you were going to say, just like stab yourself. Oh, sorry, I got to go to the hospital.
You know, that's good. Well, that's what people do. They check their watch. Oh, you know, I got to go to the airport or whatever. So it happens.
We are on the Brutally Honest Dreamers podcast.
That's right.
No, you know, a friend of mine, he doesn't like to talk to people as much as I like to talk to people. And it's funny because we're very similar, but at the same time, we're very different. And, you know, he's like, you know, Joe, you're talking to this person that, you know, they know you and you know them. It's hard to tell whether or not you actually like the person.
Oh, really?
I'm like, wait, what do you mean? He's like, well, because you talk to everyone, so it's really hard to tell if you're really into that person or if you're not into that person. And this is just him being honest with me, mm-hmm. and me being honest with everyone that's listening to this. But but the truth is like, I don't mind giving people the time of day because it's. I don't know. I just like to be nice to people, you know, treat people the way I want to be treated. And
exactly.
Hopefully it'll come back. And it has, you know, in many ways for me. So, you know, if it takes an extra 10, 15, 20 minutes to just be friendly and nice, regardless of the history I have with that person or whatever, it's like, it just doesn't matter.
Have you ever made friends with someone and realized, oh, I really don't want to be friends with this person? Has it ever happened? We just get along with everyone.
No, I don't just get along with everyone. there's really only like maybe three people that I just can't stand and have had, you know, like shouting matches with across maybe my whole life. And these are like three or four people that I never have yet to reconcile with. Like, there's been some people, but then we both got older and we reconciled and it's all cool. You know, everything's fine. But there's like three or four people. It's just like, I just don't see it happening. And it hasn't happened to date. How about for you?
Yeah. There are people that, because of my childhood, I learned to be like very friendly. I became a yes person. So I became very friendly towards everyone. And a lot of people saw that as, oh, you want to be my friend? Great. And there are some people I didn't want to be friends with. I had no common interests and there was really nothing to talk about. But because I was such a good listener and I didn't honor my personal boundaries, people would kind of invade my space all the time. And so, there was a lot of people that came into my life and I realized, wow, you're so negative all the time. And here you are and I'm letting you be negative in my space, my personal space. And it's affecting me. I go home thinking, I don't want to talk to you anymore. Yet I'm just friendly and a nice guy. So I'll go in and talk to them again. And they think I'm their best friend. So I really had trouble honoring my personal boundaries for a long time and letting certain people in to my, I don't know, sphere of influence. I don't know what you call it. But once they got into that space, then it was hard to get them out. And so I finally started weeding these people, these energy suckers out of my life. And so definitely I've attracted those kind of people in my life, but that was because I wasn't honoring and respecting myself enough to keep only the things I want in my life. So for sure.
Well, you bring up an interesting point with the negativity. I mean, do you think that those people look up to you because of the vulnerableness that you ooze, basically?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I haven't been the way I am all my life. So back then, I was, and I'm still friendly and kind, and I have good manners, and I'm all those things. But back then, there were people that I didn't necessarily resonate with. So because I think what happened over the years, if I can finally articulate this, I think what happened over the years is that I was very adaptable to other people. I was the chameleon, because when you grow up in an alcoholic household, you learn to change your behavior, on a dime, on a whim, just because you don't want to evoke the alcoholic behavior of the family member. So that's what I did. I learned to become what I believed they would want to see me as, so I wouldn't evoke dangerous behavior from them. So I took this skill that I've developed into the world. When I left home, I was able to become everyone's best friend almost instantly, because I was just so good at it. They would be like, wow, everything I need in a friend is you. Well, that's because I learned to adapt to what they needed, just like I learned to adapt to that in my childhood. And what that did, though, was allow people to kind of walk over me sometimes. A lot of people were my best friend, but then, you know, they would take advantage of my time and I wouldn't honor myself. It all came down to honoring myself, honoring personal boundaries. Instead of saying, oh, no, I can't help you move this weekend, I would say, of course I want to help you move. The total lie. Like, of course I want to help you. Of course I'll work overtime. Of course this. Yes, of course. So I said yes to everything. So it did have a lot to do with not honoring my personal boundaries and letting these people come into my life, because I was afraid to say no. I was afraid to be confrontational. Because if I'm confrontational, this is a childhood belief, if I'm confrontational, they might become dangerous. So I had to learn to eliminate that old childhood belief.
Wow. You know, it tells me a lot about myself hearing all that. I mean, I don't have the alcoholic background, but I guess even to some extent you could say that, like, kids growing up that were, like, really fearful of their own parents, Mm-hmm. You know, not because they're alcoholic, but because they're just like super stressed or super demanding or super this or super like any polarizing characteristic could bring out the same type of character trait in you as a person.
Yeah.
And I, you know, you're describing a lot of about me and it's scary.
Well, it's true. I mean, now that we're talking about it, it makes me think that anything other than a peaceful childhood forces you to create behaviors as a child. And they're usually some sort of coping behavior. So if you're not in peace and it's not easy, then as that child, you have to learn to create behavior to figure out how to make it easier on yourself, to figure out how to get out of the painful emotions that you might be feeling. And so that's what happens to children in dysfunctional homes, is that they create a behavior that doesn't necessarily work when you leave home, but they keep it. They keep those behaviors. You know what I'm saying? They develop, like, I remember being in my bedroom, cowering in my corner, hoping my alcoholic stepfather didn't smash the door open and kick my butt, because I didn't know it was going to happen. I was a kid. So, you know, he would crank the music in the house really, really loud. It would shake the walls, and he would kick holes in the walls. He would throw glasses, and, you know, I know he's done a lot of things that I can't even talk about on the air, but because it affects other family members. But he's just, when you're a kid, you don't know how to deal with this stuff, especially if you don't have an adult to talk about it with, because the other adults in the home are also threatened and doing their own behavior to survive. So you take, what do you know what to do? You don't know what to do when you're a kid. So you have to do something. So you figure out, okay, when I smile, he doesn't yell at me, or he won't drink. You know, we have these beliefs that we create. Like, maybe if I'm nicer, he'll stop drinking. Or maybe if I'm this, you know, so we take that maybe if I'm nicer into the real world or outside of the home, of childhood home, and we go, maybe if I'm nicer, then we start treating other people like we treated our family members, and go, whoa, now this is working for me, until it doesn't work anymore. And we realize, oh, wait a minute, this is starting to drain me. Because as we grow older, we start realizing that the behaviors that we did, I think I'm going to repeat myself, the behaviors that we did as a kid don't work anymore. So that's where I'm going with that.
Well, Paul, how did your family take it when you started to come out with your own blog and eventual podcast?
Well, my family supports about everything I do. My stepfather, I don't think he's ever seen it, and he's the one I talk about most. But I've gotten to a point where I've honored my personal boundaries enough that if he saw it and was offended by it, I'd be like, I don't care. I don't care if you're offended by it. I honestly don't care, because you have done some pretty damn heinous things. So you need to face the music and know that this is your own doing. The people that I talk about, I really only talk about, I shouldn't say bad, but honestly, I really only talked about the honest bad things that my stepfather did, only about him. I don't have anything else to say bad about my other family members, but I do present situations where they might be involved. For example, I had an episode once where my brother and his girlfriend, I talked about them and how they related to my stepfather. And they were kind of offended that I talked about them. That was the first time I realized, geez, you know, just because I'm honest and I'm vulnerable on the air doesn't mean my family wants to be. So in the sense that I can go on the air and talk about anything I feel like because it affects me, if I start talking like that about my family or friends or people that I love, or that love me, they might feel uncomfortable. They're not ready to take that step with me. So it was unfair for me to put them in that situation where they were now vulnerable. And I think that's a responsibility of any broadcaster, blogger, anyone online, is that you can talk about your personal life, but some people don't want to be included in you talking about that. So now I'm very much more generic. You know, I have a relative that does this, is much better off than saying, my younger sister did this. But Yeah. So my family has responded positively. My older sister loves my stuff, and you know, my mom loves my stuff. So there's people who love my stuff. At the same time, I got to be careful what I talk about on the air about them. So I've learned to take it back a little bit.
Right. I mean, is it difficult to straddle that line of censorship?
It's not difficult as long as I keep it in mind, but it was at first, because for a while there, I was very open about everything in my life. And when you're open about everything, that means, you know, you're going to talk about your brothers and sisters and girlfriends. And, you know, I talked about my wife several times, and I still do, my ex-wife now, on the show, about things that she's gone through. But this time, before, I wouldn't get so much permission, but this time I say, hey, I would like to talk about this on my show. Can I mention this? So now I am very much more careful on who I talk about. So it was hard at first because I'm so open that I just talk. And when you just talk, things come out that you don't have a problem with, but they might. So at first, yes, it was difficult.
So wait, you still talk to your ex-wife?
No, I don't talk to her anymore.
Oh, wait, I thought you said that you... I thought you just said that you talked to her.
When we were married, I was doing this. So,
When
we were married in 2013, we were still married, and I had just started the blog and the podcast. And then in the beginning of 2014, we were still married, and I was like, you know, I want to talk about this. Is it okay? And she's like, yeah, that's no problem. You know, I never mentioned her name, but I would talk about the situations I was in, because my marriage brought out a lot of my triggers. Triggers are these emotional things that you have inside of you that when you get angry, you're triggered by something that made you angry. When you're in fear, when you feel sad. So my marriage brought out some of these triggers in me that I didn't address until my marriage. So all these other relationships, I had these triggers. But when I finally got married, I finally figured out that I need to deal with these triggers inside of me. Otherwise, I'm going to lose my marriage. I ended up losing my marriage anyway. But near the end of it is when I actually got over my high judgment. Like, I had a lot of judgments against people. You know, don't get too fat. Don't eat that. Don't drink that. Because, you know, my stepfather, don't drink alcohol, daddy. You know, I didn't call him daddy, but that's how it gets, is that we don't want our parents to drink alcohol and make us feel uncomfortable when we're kids. So I took that into my relationships. I don't want you to drink. I don't want you to get addicted to sugar. So I had all these weird beliefs that, and I wanted to control people. So I was very controlling, very judgmental. It took me losing my marriage to finally learn that that was the common denominator in all my breakups, is my judgmentalness, my highly controlling behavior. And once I figured that out, I started working on myself. And that's when things changed for me. And my marriage was already on the way out the door, so there was no saving it. But it was a huge lesson for me to build another relationship in a healthy way without these triggers, without me being the way I used to be.
Paul, what would you say the biggest roadblock you've hit with going forward with the overwhelmed brain?
I don't know if I've ever hit a roadblock, because I'm the kind of person who just does it anyway. I'll just keep going forward. I would say that it hasn't been helpful not making money for a long time. Like, for the longest time, I just put out content, and that's all I did. And I wasn't even chasing money. I wasn't doing anything to make money, because really all I wanted to do was build my platform. I wanted to put something out there on the web, on the air, just to get my, I guess you could call them teachings, get my message out there to the world, just so I could put it out there and then figure out what I needed to do. I wouldn't call it a roadblock, but it was certainly a limitation of me being kind of fearful about maybe the imposter syndrome. Kind of like when I got my first fan letter. You're like, why are you writing to me? You know, you think I'm better than I don't think I'm this good, but you're writing to me saying how great I am. Like, I don't deserve this. So I had to go through a period of time where I felt like what I was teaching wasn't worthy enough. And I'm just a guy. So, you know, I didn't go through half the stuff that some of these people did, that some other people did. You know, I'm not Tony Robbins. I'm not any big name. I'm just a guy. I had an IT job before this. So how can you look at me like this? And then I had a conversation with a friend of mine who said, you are already that person. You're just not accepting it. I go, what do you mean? He goes, you're already the teacher because people see you as that. And if people see you as that, then you don't have to call yourself that because you already are that. It's like you just need to lean into it and embrace the role. I'm like, what? So my head started swirling when my friend told me this. You need to embrace the role that people see you as. And that's when things shifted for me. And I said, wow. So his exact words were lean into it. You got to lean into it. Because he was using a baseball reference. Like when a fast pitch comes, you don't back off and go, whoa, that was too fast. No, and if you're going to hit it, you're going to lean into it and nail it. I was like, you know, that's a great analogy. So ever since then, I've shifted. I said, you know what? I'm going to embrace this teacher that people see me as. And once I did that, all my fears went away and I decided to become more of an expert than I was, if I was at all. I don't know. But that's what was preventing me from becoming more of my potential. I think we all have this potential in us that we can be an expert, but we don't think we're good enough. We don't think we're smart enough. But if we embrace that we are the person that can do this, then suddenly we have the resources and suddenly we have the energy and the time to do it, to actually become the expert, to become the teacher, the coach, whatever you're striving for. So that's where it shifted. I think so. When I look back on it, it wasn't really a roadblock, but in a sense, if I had never had this conversation with my friend, I probably still would have been moving forward in fear. And that's the difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough though to embrace it because you have that, and I imagine you have the same feeling. That's like, you don't want people to think negatively of you because, oh man, he's just so cocky that he's the teacher and he must be a know-it-all.
Well, that's just it. That's just it. Exactly. And you don't want to come off that way because especially if you're not that way, people aren't going to see you that way. If you really aren't cocky and arrogant, then people aren't going to detect that. Some people will, but most people are not going to. And really, the secret to not appearing cocky or arrogant is to continue being vulnerable. Continue showing people that you do have your weaknesses. So you just don't go on there and say, like we were talking about in the beginning of this conversation. I don't know if we aired it or not, but when we talked about someone dominating a room, someone just being forceful in their presentation and not letting anyone else talk, or they're just continuing to talk and talk and talk. That's kind of arrogant. That's kind of cocky. It can be. But if that person said, you know what? I get scared sometimes. Everyone's going to listen. You know, it's so true because you are being vulnerable because like, whoa, he has a heart. He has emotions. He actually cares. And he trusts us enough to be vulnerable in this situation. So I think that's the secret to not being cocky and arrogant, is choosing to be not only the leader you are, because we're all leaders in some way, but also vulnerable, saying, you know what? I'm going to lead us into battle. I'm afraid this might not work, but we're going to do it and we're going to do our best. When you have that kind of attitude, people not see you. They do not see you as cocky or arrogant. They see you as a human that's just doing the best they can for other people or for themselves or whatever.
The only thing I could really add to that or append to it is ask questions.
Mm, yes.
You know, ask intelligent, well thought out questions. Not that you have to like sit there and think 20 minutes and like, oh man, no one's even staying around at this point. But the idea that you are interested, you know, that you're interested in their answers just because you can fill that into what you are looking at from your perspective. And that's really what it comes down to for me is I love different people's perspectives. Like if I, you know, traveling to me, I could care less about seeing something while traveling. Meeting people, that's what I want to do. Like, I just want to go around and just meet the people in like another country. And that's one of the best parts about this show is for me, I get to talk to people from all around the world that I would have no reason to talk to otherwise.
No, that's true. I get that.
So you recently left your job, though.
It's not so recent. Like, it was in – there's a story behind that, actually. I was working at the hospital doing IT work. Basically, they were building a new hospital in Oregon. I got on there. I've been in IT all my life, so that's where I get. That's how I made money all up to this point. So I was on a job there. I was a contractor, And it was going to last about a year, year and a half. But by the end of the job, they kept promising me that they would have a position for me. You know, 6 months before I ended up leaving that job, they were like, we've got a position for you. We love you. We want to keep you. So I was getting excited. I was thinking, okay, I could do this full time. This is great. Month after month would go by and the manager would say, oh man, we just love you. This is great. You're definitely going to work here. I'm like, great. So I just felt good. And then it was getting closer and closer. And I'm like, you know, you keep promising me that you're going to hire me, but I haven't seen anything happen yet. So I finally cornered one of the higher level managers. And I said, tell me the truth. When this job ends, where are you going to put me? What's my future here? And he ended up saying, well, just watch the job boards. You never know. I'm like, what? What? After all this time, you've been promising me that I'm going to, you know, work here and you'll have a job for me. So when I heard that news, he's like, just watch the job boards. Like when I heard that news, I was like, oh. And I just felt flushed. I was like, oh, I felt so bad. I just felt, oh, what am I going to do now? This may not last. So it took about 2 days of me moping and just being miserable, going, oh man, I thought I had a future here. And after the 2 days, I was like, you know what? This is the first time I've ever had this thought. I need to become an entrepreneur. This is mid-2013. I need to do something with my life. I need to take the reins of my life and take control, because I'm so sick of being manipulated, in the sense that when you work for someone else, you have no idea if you're going to have a job in a day or a month or a year. You just don't know. So I realized that being an entrepreneur is going to be a lot of hard work, but at least if I don't, at least I'm not going to fire myself the next day. You know, at least I am in control. And it, you know, I'm going to lose money, I'm going to lose benefits, but what will I gain? So that's what happened in mid-2013. I decided to become an entrepreneur. And I was like, well, the next question, what do I do? Like, I want to do my own thing. Oh, well, I could run a computer business. No, I tried that before, even though I didn't think I was an entrepreneur, but I tried to run a computer business before and I was terrible at it because I just didn't like it. I was like, oh, what am I going to do? So I went to websites like Smart Passive Income, and I ended up finding like podcasts like Entrepreneur on Fire and other podcasts that you can listen to interviews with, what are they called? Entrepreneurs. And I started getting ideas. But the idea that kept popping into my head was podcasting. I'm like, why? And then I realized, ever since I was a kid, or at least old enough to know, I wanted to be a radio broadcaster. You know, those low-paid wage guys. I wanted to be a radio broadcaster. And I don't know why, but it's just something I was really attracted to. So podcasting was the next best thing, if not the best thing, since radio broadcasting, because now it's worldwide and it's digital and you can do it anytime. So that's what I did. I started looking into podcasting, and then I was like, okay, what am I going to talk about? And the question that came up was, what do I like talking about more than anything? And what could I talk about until I'm blue in the face? It was personal growth. I was like, great, let's do that. So I think I bought my website and I just started doing putting all the pieces together one at a time. Wrote my first blog article, and I was like, hey, I could do this. I could talk about this. And then I spent a lot of money on audio equipment, got my podcast up and running, and just went for it. And just said, you know what? I don't know how to use any of this audio equipment, but I'm going to put it on my desk and figure it out. And there was a quote that I heard on one of John Dumas's shows, Entrepreneur Fire. And I think it was, I don't know who it was, but he said, he was quoting somebody else, and he said, jump off the cliff and build your wings on the way down. I was like, that is a great analogy for what I'm doing, for a lot of what a lot of entrepreneurs are doing, is that they are jumping into it and just, you know what? You're either going to die because you're going to hit the ground, or you're going to build those wings and you're going to fly. So it's kind of a silly analogy, but it does work for me, because that's exactly what I did. I ended up saving enough money to build my runway, and then jumping off the cliff, meaning I quit my job at the end of that year. They could have put me somewhere, but they weren't hiring me full time. And I was like, you know what? I'm taking control of my life now. I quit my job and just went into this full time. And for the last year and 2 or 3 months now, I've been doing nothing but this, spending as little as possible, building the foundation, the platform, so that someday I could probably sustain myself doing this. And now I'm starting to see some of the results of doing this, starting to be able to sustain myself in small ways. I'm not quite there yet, but just writing an ebook, putting something online that actually sells while I'm sleeping, very helpful. It's a good start.
It is. It definitely is a good start. And it's a good way to, you know, help build your brand.
Yes.
And build what your goal is, which is to help other people. And, you know, in order to do that outside of just the realm of like the people you work with, you do need money and you do need time and that stuff. Well, it all revolves around money.
It does. And money runs the world. And we have to know that no matter what we do, it has to have a sum. Whatever we do, it takes up resources. Typically, those resources are money. So whatever we do, we need to replenish resources doing it. It's the way the universe, it's the laws of cosmology. I think that's the word. It's the cosmic laws of the universe. Like any energy that's destroyed gets like transmuted, or it never gets destroyed. It gets transmuted or whatever. But that's what I figured out, is that when you put your time, money, or energy towards something, you have to replenish that. You have to get that back somehow. So either you have it in reserves as your runway, or you create a sustainable system that continues to bring it back. Because I think the reason I'm saying that is because I think a lot of people, especially in the online entrepreneur world, go into it just giving but never selling, because they don't feel right selling. They don't feel like, no, I can't sell this. Maybe they don't feel like it's worth it, or they're afraid to ask for money. They're afraid to ask for the sale. But when they think about their own longevity in doing something, if you don't sell, you don't last. You know, does that make sense? That's like,
no, it totally makes sense. In fact, yeah. I just wrote an article, a very long article.
Oh, did you?
About,
I should read it,
the fear of asking for money, for donations and support. Mm. And because I've recently just worked up the courage to finally put a support page together. I mean, it's more than just donating, but it's, you know, how people can support the show in other ways.
Oh, excellent.
But yeah, so it's definitely difficult. And anybody that wants to check that out, it's at jpar.co, right? The first article at the top, fear of, I think it was fear, or it was the, hold on, I'll look it up so I know. So I sound intelligent about, yeah, my course, own show. It's fear of asking, and it's the fear, guilt, and agony of asking for money donations.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it took me a while to write it because it's quite lengthy, but it really breaks down like all the reasons that I have that I don't like asking for money. I feel like there's other people that are more deserving of it, and I don't want to be a sellout or a shill for somebody else. So it's been difficult to deal with those types of feelings.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that I've had to deal with that too. You know, I don't want to sell. I don't want to go on the air and sell something. There's something that Google did when they first came out, and I've always appreciated this model. Google said, hey world, we're going to give you this search engine for free. I'm like, wow. So I started using it, and it was great, not realizing that they were making money on the back end through people who wanted to pay them. So Google really never looked to sell. I mean, they did. There was a model. There was a model of sustainability there and profit there. But Google didn't have to seek people to buy advertising. These people wanted to be part of it. They actually sought Google out because everyone's using Google. So let's go where the people are that are using Google, and we'll buy ad space. So when people search, our results will appear at the top or on the side or whatever. So I love, it's brilliant that Google said, we're going to give you this for free. And then people still paid. There's still some aspect of it that could be paid for, just like podcast sponsorships. What you're doing is giving your show to the world for free. But a sponsor who wants to connect with your audience would be happy to pay you to connect with the audience that you're talking to. You know, you start to see things when you give enough. This is where that quote comes in, I forget how you say it. The more you give to the world, the more you get back. Something like that. I think it's a Zig Ziglar quote, or Jim Rohn or somebody. But what I notice is that the more you give, it's not necessarily going to come back from those you're giving to. And that's been my biggest lesson throughout this, is that I give all I can and all I know to the world. And then other aspects of people who want to connect with either my audience or want to be part of what I have out there are coming into play. I had a sponsor reach out to me recently, and I wrote my ebook, and that's a different aspect. Even though my main stuff is the blog and the podcast, I wrote this ebook that's an aspect of what I do. So I'm not selling the podcast. I'm not selling the blog. And I barely sell on the podcast or the blog except for like a sponsor or two. But so it's interesting how when I went into this, what I thought would make the money is really background stuff. I thought it was going to be the foreground stuff. Like I would have to sell. I have to have these webinars and I have to sell a product and create a product and then just talk about it all the time. But what it turns out is that the more people that enjoy your show and the more value they get from it, then other people in other aspects of the world that may not necessarily listen to your show but want to be part of the big thing that you've created now suddenly find a motive to be part of that, if that makes any sense.
No, it definitely makes a lot of sense, actually. Oh, crap, I had something for this.
That's okay.
You know, Paul, it's funny that you mentioned webinars.
Mm.
And the reason is because I recently told somebody that, recently in the last few months, that I don't want to do the webinar thing. And I'm not going to. I will figure out how to make this work without trying to do these webinars. And the reason is because I don't want to spend my time doing that. That's not creative. It's just a sales thing. It is work. It's a lot of work. This, what I'm doing right now, is not work. It's fun, but it's valuable. And I believe that it's valuable. Not that I would sell the show, you know, to my audience or anything like that. But point being is like the last thing I want to do is sit around and do a bunch of webinars trying to hopefully get a couple people to buy into something for like $500. that's not the legacy I want to leave behind. It's not the... That's not why I left my family's business, you know, my job security and everything to go try and be a salesman all day. Because when I did that in my family's business, I hated it. Like I could talk to people, but you know what? Cold calling on people is just it's painful. Fun. It's painful. I just don't want to do it. And it doesn't matter that I'm, you know, able to talk to people. I just don't want to do it.
I hear you.
But, you know, so I'm glad that there's somebody else out there that feels the same way I do about webinars. And not that they aren't useful, not that I haven't sat in some of them and have, you know, picked up a couple useful tips here and there out of them. But when it comes to money, I just, like, I'd rather just experience it and then I have the experience.
Well, you know, webinars themselves aren't, you know, terrible. They usually, I think what we're used to now as entrepreneurs is that, okay, we're going to watch a webinar, get three, quote, golden tips, and then we're going to get a sales pitch at the end. It's typically what happens in a webinar. But I've seen webinars where they said, hey, you know what? I'm not here to sell you anything. We're just going to talk about this stuff. And I'm like, wow. And then what happens is it creates a passive want to buy instead of an active want to buy. So at the end, they're not doing the sales pitch. Get it today for $197. It's typically $699. Instead of that, they're saying, hey, you know, we have a product for sale. You're welcome to go check it out, but I'm not here to talk about that today. And when you can create a webinar like that, where it's more permissive instead of authoritative, you're allowing the watcher, the person watching, to make the decision, empowering them, really. You're empowering them to make the decision on their own. I'm willing to bet that that will more often get people to buy your product. So you don't even have to ask for the sale. But what you end up doing is you make them feel good that you're giving them the information. Now, it's not a manipulation. I mean, some people could use it for manipulation. But if you really are authentic and wanting to give away this information, and a good way to do it is through video or through a webinar, then I say, by all means, do it. And you don't even have to ask for it. You don't have to do the sales pitch. You don't have to do the webinar, you know, 101 course to create sales, unless that's your primary goal. And a lot of people's primary goal is to profit and sell and build their email list through webinars. We all know that, but some people don't, but most of us entrepreneurs know that. But I truly believe in doing things differently than the cookie cutter model that everyone's using. So when you say, I don't want to do webinars, it's just so salesy, and it's true. I mean, if you did webinars the way everyone else did webinars, I probably wouldn't watch, because I'm just, you get to the point where it's like, okay, you gave me the information. However, I can't really use that information unless I buy your system. So what's the point of this information? But if you do it in the sense that, hey, I'm going to give you everything, people are going to trust you. It's like, wow, if you do it differently, that's what I do with my show. I think we talked earlier, you and I did, about other podcasters told me not to do this, or you said something like that. I figured out at the beginning of when I first started creating the Overwhelmed Brain podcast, what I wanted to do was what everybody told me not to do. That's exactly what I wanted to do. They said, you need to shorten your intro so it's 12 seconds long. And I'm like, now my intros are over 2 minutes.
Wow.
But I make them interesting. They're different every week. I was like, you know what? I'm going to break the mold here. And they said something else. I forget. There was a few things that they said. You need to do this. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. And I was like, all right, what would happen if I did everything the opposite? Kind of me. I just do the opposite thinking. Because everyone's used to the patterns. We get stuck in the patterns. We hear the cookie cutter shows that have the same questions over and over again. And some of them are fantastic. I'm not making fun of any of them. But there's a lot of clones out there. And you're like, wow, another show that's the same person, the same questions as the last show did. Okay. I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I probably won't listen to it again, because I already have this other show. And that's the people who are the most successful are the ones who do it differently. There are some people that can clone someone else and make sales and probably get away with it. But if you're going to stand out, you have to be different. So I don't know what got me off on that, but we were talking about webinars. And I do believe that webinars can be a valuable thing, because really all it is a educational video. But if you use the same format, even though it will work on a lot of people, if you don't feel right, if you don't feel authentic, then how are you going to come across on the webinar? And that just comes back to being your authentic self, being your vulnerable self. So I agree with you. I don't like asking for the sale, so to speak, because it feels like you just led me on this whole time just to ask for the sale. And I hate people. I hate when people feel that way. I don't want them to feel like I duped them. So I would rather just say, hey, you know what? I got a book for sale. I got a product for sale. Feel free to get it if you want. I'm not here to talk about that. Everything I'm talking about is in the product. So if you want more, you can feel free to do it. But I'm not here to wrangle you in, I should say.
No, and I have heard of success where people give everything away at the webinar and they don't even really ask for the sale. They just mention, in some cases, don't even mention it. And people seek after them because of that. And
I like that.
Yeah, I it does make sense. But for me personally, it's just something that I don't plan on doing, but also because I really don't want to take the time to have to develop a product like that.
I get you.
But that's just me.
It's a lot of time and effort. A lot of time and effort to create something and then create a webinar on it. And then, yeah, especially if you have another job or kids or
anything, really. Anything. I mean, getting anything done during a day is tough, even when there's nobody home.
That's true. It is true.
I mean, heck, we're on a call right now.
I know. What else could we be doing?
At this point, it's lunchtime. It's past lunchtime. So.
Yeah.
But, Paul, what was your childhood dream growing up?
Well, I think when I was a kid, I probably wanted to be a jet pilot, only because I liked playing with those toys. So you kind of have aspirations of doing things that you imagine yourself doing when you're a kid. But as I grew older, I realized, one, I wanted to kind of be the center of attention. I think growing up in the dysfunctional household I was in, we used kind of humor to get through some of the tough times. So I found out that the funnier I was, the more attention I got and the better I felt about myself. So I decided to just kind of pursue that in the sense that not to become a comedian, but just to be more outwardly funny at times when situations called for it. So it's not like a career aspiration that I had, but that did lead me into where I am today. Because as soon as you put yourself on the air, you are the center of attention for people. So for the longest time, I did, and it was an ego thing for the longest time too, I did want to be the center of attention. And then in high school, you know, I was definitely more of an outcast. I was a skateboarder, long hair, and definitely didn't get along too well with the jocks. I mean, they just kind of ignored me or made fun of me. But I remember that changing after I got a cool car, and everyone's like, wow, I like your car. I'm like, okay, this is helping me feel better about myself. But after high school, it was like, what do I want to do with my life? And it wasn't until I got into technology, like I got a job when I was 21 working in with all these computers and stuff, that I said, this is what I want to dedicate my life to. Because I guess that's mostly what happened, is like when I was 16, I got an old IBM PC with two big floppy drives and I fell in love with it. I was like, this is fun. It's 1986. So back then computers were like $10,000, but I just happened to get one for my father's work. I started using that and started programming and coding. And so I guess as a child, I think I wanted more than I ended up doing with my life, because as a child, I wanted to kind of fly jets or something. And then when I got my first computer and I realized, wow, this is so much fun, that's what I started going towards. So I guess you could say that I did fulfill a dream that I had when I was 16 of being in technology. At the same time, I still wanted to be the center of attention. So as I grew up with technology, got into my 30s and now my 40s, I took that, all that experience I had with technology and my initial desire to be the center of attention and made myself a podcast and a blog. And I just had to take the ego out of the equation. So I use enough of the ego to keep me motivated every day to do what I keep doing, because you gotta love what you're doing to keep going. So I let that ego come in and go, okay, I still love what I'm doing. I still love, you know, being out there, having a message for people, teaching people. But it did help me. You know, I kind of put this all in perspective, because the combination of things that we have in our lives does bring us to a point to where we are, unless we just went off on a course that, because our father told us to, or our mother told us to, or we were supposed to go to college, or we were supposed to be this person in life, instead of following what we desire most. So I do feel like I have been following what I've desired most.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking about that myself, is the two things I wanted to be was a child psychologist and a DJ. And I basically have made both of those come true over the years.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, I'm not a child psychologist per se, but I do a lot with kids and stuff like that.
Kidding.
And working in a teen center, helping other kids, dealing with much worse situations than I ever had to deal with.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
Yeah, it was awesome while it lasted. I mean, it was about 10 years ago now, but for the 3 or so years that it lasted, it was a really great experience. And now with this show, it helps me, you know, open up a whole new world of people that I get to reach out to and help. So it's weird how it all works out in the end.
Did you want to be a child psychologist when you were a child?
Yeah. When I was, I was like six, seven years old. My parents were going through a divorce, and I remember crying on my grandmother's floor, because I was the only boy in the family, and I still am the only boy in the family, to take over the family business. And I was like, I don't want to take over the family business. I want to help other kids. You know, I want to be a child psychologist. And then eventually it set in that it was going to be like, you know, 8 to 10 years of college. And I was like, not really feeling that.
How could you have that thought at seven?
I don't know, man. I wonder that myself, but that's just, I don't know. It's just who I am, part of who I am, I guess.
And then you got, and then you became a DJ, you said?
Yeah, yeah. When I was about 8 to 10 years old, I found out about DJs, and I really, really wanted to be a DJ, like the nighttime DJs, not like the on the radio DJs, but like the ones they would have in the nightclubs and stuff like that, like getting to play music that sounded different than what you would hear day to day on the radio. So I was like, okay. Well, you know. But there was no one really to foster that in me until I was a senior in high school, when I had some equipment that I had gotten through when I was in high school, but I had no idea how to use it, and the internet hadn't had YouTube yet, and you know, it wasn't that I really didn't know what I was doing until senior year, when I met the right people to really bring me along with it, and then I've been, you know, off and on DJing ever since.
That's cool, because I've read and learned myself that when you follow, how do you find out what your passion is? You know, how do you figure out what your passion is? And people always say the clues are in your past, clues are in your childhood. What did you absolutely love doing? And, you know, when you started, like 5 hours later, you didn't even realize 5 hours went by. What did you love doing when you were a kid? And that's usually a clue to what you're passionate about. And so I was very creative as a kid. Loved drawing. I loved doing all the creative stuff and playing music, even though I was terrible at it, and anything creative. So every job I got, I found a way to be creative in it. And then, of course, you know, creating this show, being an entrepreneur, you have to be absolutely creative and just do things that are just different, like I was talking about, than everyone else. So I do find that a lot of the stuff I was passionate about, I wasn't passionate about back then. I would just enjoy doing it. A lot of the stuff that I enjoyed doing as a child does come out in different ways, just different aspects of it. They're not exact, but that's what I read. It's like, you will find your passion by looking in the past to figure out what you used to love to do. Good way to look at it.
Yeah, yeah. It's just something that just occurred to me, I think, earlier today, this morning or something, or last night, something like that. It just recently occurred to me, like, oh man, I actually am making that part of it come true. And I had told that story before. I'm not sure if it was on this show, but definitely on some other shows.
It's cool.
And yeah, it's just weird how it just comes full circle. But speaking of going full circle, what are your dreams for the future look like?
I don't think about the future much. I mean, the only thing I think about in the future, I know it's terrible. Right now, my focus is on generating an income. Creating these ebooks is one way to do it, because I want to create a bunch of ebooks this year that are based on the topics of my show. Because I talk about anything from personal boundaries, values, depression, anxiety, how to deal with, like my next book is How to Deal with Irrational People, which I think is a great topic to talk about. My immediate future for this year is going to be creating ebooks, so I can have something that sits there, sells while I'm sleeping. I love the idea of something selling while I'm sleeping. And that way I'm not asking for money. It's just online. If somebody finds it and they want it, they just buy it. So I have a feeling the more ebooks I have, if they like one of them, they'll buy the others too. So as far as income-wise, that's my main focus with that. As far as the show is concerned, I'm going to continue pushing out new episodes every week. I've also gotten different types of offers for like audiobook reading and things like that. So there's other streams of income as far as that's concerned. So business-wise, it's just a matter of finding how many avenues of replenishing resources I can find, replenishing the money I've spent on this to come back to me in ways that I can actually sustain and not live off of savings and things like that. And again, that's started. So that's already a ball in motion. But personally, you know, I'm going to be moving to Georgia in like a week and a half, like really, really close, getting out of New Hampshire. And I'll be with a girl down there that I met several months ago. We've just been doing a long distance thing for a while. And I'm looking forward to just starting a new life down there. I've never been one to stay in one place for too long. I always go where my heart takes me. So we'll see if my heart keeps me there for, you know, for a long time. If she wants to stay in Georgia or if she wants to move, great. But I'm hoping to make this next relationship last. Now that I've gone over a lot of my triggers, my emotional baggage has been left at the airport, maybe. Once that's done, you know, once I establish myself down in Georgia, I really want to end up meeting more people, because I really do believe that the secret to success is your network. The more you network with people, the more you get to know people. I mean, you're one to talk. You network with people all the time. The more people you know, the more resources you have. Because when you know somebody that knows somebody, or when you know somebody that knows something that you need, then you have it at your disposal anytime you need it. So I really love the idea of just generating a large network like I have online now. But you know, I'll be moving to the Atlanta area, so I want to find more people to connect with down there that are like-minded, that want to be successful, and that we can, you know, kind of mastermind it for a while and just see if we can push each other to new levels. So it's, I say that I don't really think about the future too much, because I really do kind of live day to day, because the more you think about what could go wrong, the more you worry about. And I don't like worrying, so I try not to go that route, yet I plan enough in advance so I don't have to worry. I do have to kind of build a little runway every now and then just to make sure that I don't worry too much. Because if I figure something out, like, oh man, I'm going to lose all this money, I'll be down for days. I know myself well enough that once I get over it, I'm fine. I never think about it again. But if I think, oh, this isn't going to work out, oh no, if I start stressing about it too much, then it's like, oh, you lost me.
I'd imagine it's going to be a lot more people around you being down in Georgia than in New Hampshire.
There's no one up here.
Hey, that's not true. I know a couple podcasters up your way.
Yeah, there are podcasters up here, but there's no one to... I mean, everyone's few and far between. Like, I tried to start a personal growth group up here and hardly anyone showed. I'm like, is anyone into personal growth up here? And I just could not get people to show up. I did have a few people show up and it just didn't stick around. It just didn't last. You know, people have their own things to do and, you know, and they have to travel really far. That's one thing, living kind of a country-esque area up here, is that people have to travel really far to go anywhere. And it's like, in this day and age, we need things faster. We think we need things faster, but we want things faster. And so I'm thinking, okay, if I live in a big city, I'll probably have more access to more things. Like something my dad told me a long time ago. I don't know if it's true or not, but he goes, if you want money, you got to move where the money is. I'm like, that's interesting.
So, was he a prospector?
No, it sounds like a... He was into construction. He would help people build their houses and stuff. So he would go to where wealthy people lived. And it didn't really work out for him. So I don't know if that's the best advice. I was told not to take advice from unhappy broke people. So I stopped listening to that kind of advice from people that haven't shown their results the way I want my own results.
Paul, I know we've shared so much stuff here.
I'm just getting started.
Well, it's okay, because I'm about to ask you if, before you share how people can connect with you, do you have any last thoughts you'd like to share?
Probably I do. The reason I say that is because there's all kinds of stuff swimming in my head. Like, one of the things that swims in my head all the time is that so many people are unhappy. And there are a multitude of reasons for them being unhappy. And the advice I like to give people is, when you're unhappy, there's usually something inside of you that you haven't expressed yet to someone. And the reason you haven't expressed it to someone is because you don't feel safe enough to express it. When you're unhappy for any reason, when you feel this sadness or fear or whatever's happening inside of you, find someone that you feel safe enough with that you could tell them your embarrassments, your shame, your guilt, your fears. find someone that you feel safe enough to talk about with, who's not there to give you advice, but is this just there to listen. When you find someone that can absolutely listen without judging you, without making comments like, why would you do that? Or things like that, then you get to release a lot of what's going on inside of you. I noticed this when I went to my first therapist. This is right after a 13-year relationship I had. She broke up with me and I went into a depression. I was like, man, I got to do something about this depression. I hate this feeling. So I went to this therapist and she hardly talked at all. She asked like one question. I talked for 20 minutes. She asked another question. I talked for 20 minutes. But when I left the office, $120 later, I closed the door behind me and suddenly I felt like, wow, I feel really good. And it was because I was able to express all the things in a safe environment without somebody there to judge me. So whether it's a therapist, a friend, a parent, a lover, whatever, I think it's so important to find someone that you trust enough to tell them your deepest, darkest secrets or things going on inside of you. Because when you do that, you get to release what you've been hanging on to for years and years and years. And the good story, a good story about that is when I met this woman that was going to be my wife. About a couple months into our relationship, I was still depressed from my last breakup. So I still had this depression going on inside of me. And it was hard for her to deal with this because she was bright and energetic and fun. And here I am, this depressed guy. And one night she's like, you know, I'm going to leave. I'm like, why? Why are you going to leave? She goes, I can't be around you. You're always depressed. And I was like, what? Suddenly my head started swirling. I realized, oh my God, I'm about to lose another relationship here. I can't, oh my God, it's just, the reality kicked in. I don't know what happened inside my head, but it was so real. And I didn't want to lose it so bad that I suddenly started crying and I broke down and I was bawling. And she's like, oh my God, what's wrong? And I just realized after 30 something years, how much I hated my stepfather. And that's how it came out. It's like I've held on to this all this time. It wasn't even about the depression about my breakup. The reason I was depressed, it was because of other things before I even got into that relationship. There's always the beginning of why we feel a certain way, and it usually stems from childhood. When I realized how much I hated my stepfather, because we're not supposed to hate, right? So you don't say, I don't want to hate. That's bad to hate. But when I finally said I hated him, it came out and I was able to release it. And I just, like I said, I fell down on the floor and I had my head on her lap and I was just crying and I just felt like a girl. Sorry, girls. But
no.
Well, you know, girls can show their emotions a lot easier than guys can. So I just felt like this emotional roller coaster was happening. And after that, I felt light. Like I left that therapist office. I felt light. And it was the first time I realized, gee, when I express what's really going on inside of me, the deepest, darkest stuff going on inside of me, things I don't want to talk about with anyone, I release it and I feel better and I feel happier. So there's my extremely extended version. Last piece of advice is that find someone that you can feel safe with to tell them everything that's going on with inside of you, at least the deepest, darkest, hardest stuff to talk about. And if you can't find anyone, if no one is like that in your life, then write it down. Write it down. I don't really give the advice of journaling, even though it's a great idea. But even like write an email to someone that you want to say something to and then never send it. Or write a letter and then never send it. And, you know, wait on it for a few days. And if you want to, you can send it. Because a few days later, the emotions will die down. But what happens when you write is you slow the process of thinking down. And when you're able to slow that process down, then the thoughts that quickly pass by when you're thinking, you know, to yourself, get articulated. And you go, oh, I didn't realize I felt this way. Because that's what I did when I broke up. Or when my wife broke up with me and we got divorced, is that I wrote her this email and I was angry. So I wrote this long email and I was really angry in this email. I was like, okay, let me reread this to make sure it's exactly what I want to say. And when I reread it, I was like, wow, I don't feel so angry anymore. So let me remove this word and let me change this sentence. And so I did that again. And then I looked at it and I go, okay, now I'll reread it and make sure it's exactly what I want to say. And I started removing a lot more because all the emotional energy that I just released by writing, it was gone. I didn't feel that way anymore. And by the time I was done sending the letter to her, it was no longer blaming and accusatory, and it was taking responsibility for my role in the relationship ending. It was a totally different thing. So I started off being angry at her, saying it's, you know, her fault and this and this and this, to, wow, I'm responsible for everything that happened in this relationship. If I hadn't written it down or typed it, if I hadn't done that and slowed down my thought processes, and I wouldn't have been able to release that emotional buildup that I had. And after I did that, I let go of my marriage. It was done. It was over. And I felt good. So that's my last piece of advice. Sorry about that.
No. There's nothing to be sorry about. I think that writing it down and then sitting on it can definitely be very helpful, and as well as screaming, yes, to the emptiness of a room or something, not in someone's face. But I mean, sometimes to someone's face, but it's usually just going to make you look like a jerk and embarrassed and can be misconstrued.
Typically.
But yeah.
That's great advice.
Screaming definitely helps.
Yeah. I've told people, go into your car and scream. If you can't find someone to talk to, then, you know, talk to someone in your car, an invisible person. It helps to just to emote it, get it out, express it. Emotion is always looking for a voice to get out. So once you express it, you can release a lot of stuff. A lot of people hold it in. Like, I don't want to show that side of myself. I don't want to be vulnerable, because that's what it is. They feel like if they're vulnerable, they'll feel more pain. But if they release it, then that goes away.
Well, I mean, not to go down that rabbit hole, but
why not?
There's a whole lot that can be said for being pressured into hating yourself. And needing to be perfect and needing to put on a presentation, so and the psychological screwed upness of that.
Yes, that would be a rabbit hole we could definitely approach.
But you know, Paul, I would love for you to connect. I would love, Paul. I would love for you to connect with Paul. Paul, I would love you to tell my audience how they can connect with you.
They can reach me at theoverwhelmedbrain.com. I have a podcast that I release once a week. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, called The Overwhelmed Brain. And certainly if you have any questions, just reach out to me. I have a contact form there. Happy to help.
Awesome. Well, I will have that website on howtodream.co, so everyone can definitely find it.
Nice. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Paul, it's been an amazing time. I'm really looking forward for everybody to hear this episode, because it's definitely personal for you and for me, and has a ton of good information as far as being honest and sometimes brutally honest.
I've enjoyed this time. I love how you stretch my mind with some of these questions. And I was just talking to someone yesterday. Like, I like people who ask me questions that challenge me, because you do hear a lot of the same questions on shows like this, but you definitely ask questions that challenge me, and I definitely enjoyed that. So thank you. And thank you for having me on. This has been a good time.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And I'm glad I tried a challenge without embarrassing my guests. Of course, that's all part of the editing process, the magic that goes on after the fact, the hour to 3 hours of brutal truth.
You'll change my no's to yeses.
Yes.
So you listen to my show often? Yes. So do you want to buy my product? Yes. I would love to support you. You cut it up.
Awesome. Can't wait to drop that in everywhere.
That's right.
I'll have soundboard Paul here. So Paul, I would love to have you on the show again at some point.
Yeah, man. How long have you had this show out?
Like 9 months.
9 months?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out now what I'm going to do for my 1 year anniversary coming up in May.
Yeah, you got to do something special.
Yeah, I definitely do. It's tough coming up with what to do. What did you do for your 1 year?
I actually haven't done a 1 year. I just did an episode number, 50.
Oh, so when congratulations!
I've had it. I'm on episode number 75 now. So when I hit episode 50, I decided to make it really special flashback episode, but it was me talking and then highlights of the different episodes, the different people I've had on, the different things I talked about. And that turned out pretty good. So I really liked it. Like, you could go back and highlight some of the things that people have said and then talk in between. Say, you know, I really like what Joe said in this interview about how to get along with people or something. And then you play the clip.
That something like that. A lot of work.
It is. But it's your special episode, you know? You come out with a special episode.
I don't know. I'm thinking like house party, and then we'll do like some kind of Google Hangout on air thing where people can, you know, publicly come into the event. And
you could do something live. That'd be great.
Yeah. Do some like live episode and have like previous guests come on into the Google Hangout and really like make a big deal out of it. You know, like I said, like do a whole house party or something.
That'd be fun.
Yeah, it's something, you know, to celebrate. I mean, 1 year is tough. I mean, a lot of these shows don't make it past like 25 episodes.
If that, I know. There's one show out there called Dude, Where's My Health? You ever seen that?
No.
There's a friend of mine, Clark Danger. He created this podcast a few years ago, apparently, or a couple years ago. And he abandoned it after like 6 or 7 episodes. But it ended up on What's Hot again. And it ended up like on the, like all his episodes became top episodes. Like it just came out from the dead, came back from the dead. And it's like now sitting in these high rankings, but he's still not doing anything with it. It's like, man, you could totally revive that. Somebody likes you out there.
Or you should sell the stream to someone else.
Oh my God, that's funny.
Do something with it.
I just had someone ask, I got to respond to them, if I could have my old episodes on CD.
What?
I'm like, wow. I know. I'm like, what? She goes, I want to give it to a friend. I'm like, wow.
Give the gift of a web address. But hey, there's an opportunity for you to make a couple bucks, you know?
Yeah, so I'm thinking about what I could do with that. Obviously, I can't put like several hour long episodes on CD unless I
MP3'd it.
Yeah, MP3'd it, exactly. So I don't know if, you know, a lot of CD players don't play. I mean, today's do. But who knows? If she has to give a CD to a friend, then that friend probably does not have an MP3 CD player. Because they could just look up my website. So
I'm surprised that she doesn't just burn it for them.
I don't know. I didn't,
or is that past, like, public knowledge at this point? Like, because it was a thing that people did, and then all, like,
that's a good point.
Just as quick as it came in, it went out.
That's a good point. It's probably what it is. It's like the trend, the phase is gone because we don't need to do it anymore.
Yeah,
it's a good point.
I don't know. It wouldn't take you too long to burn them, but then to ship them. So I mean, like I said, it's definitely worth at least a couple bucks for the time and effort. It's two words I keep coming back to over and over and over again: time and effort.
That's true. Everything is time and effort. No, it's a good show though, man.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And I hope everyone goes and checks out your show, The Overwhelmed Mind, The Overwhelmed Brain.
People want to say that. I almost did that one. I was like, nah, brain's a better word. I think overwhelmedmind.com was already taken too.
Well, that makes the decision a lot easier.
Exactly. I got to use something that's not used right now. So no, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. And I really enjoyed getting to know your story too, because it's pretty interesting. Wanting to be a child psychologist at 7 years old.
Yeah. I should have made that happen.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, you know, I'm not dead yet. I could still make it happen. But yeah, you know, I think I'm better off going on the path I'm on.
I think you got something going on here, so I would stick with it.
Well, Paul, again, thank you so much for taking the time. And I really am looking forward to having you on the show again in like 6 months to a year to follow up on how your move to Atlanta has gone for you.
Oh, that's a good idea. Find out where I am. Where are they now? Oh, my God. I better have a success story. That's for sure.
I think you will, man. I think you will. And I had some, it's a flash in my mind.
You should keep some of this stuff in. It's hilarious.
I probably will.
You're speechless. We start laughing. No, I get it. It's like some interviews that I do. Oh, my God. I just like sometimes they'll say something and I have nothing to add. Like, you said everything.
You got to pick up the next question. You just got to be like, oh, that's cool. You totally walked all over the question I was about to ask. So let's just move on. And
exactly. Exactly. So I think, oh, yeah, I'm probably guilty of that, too. But
you are going to go down as more than likely. I mean, I had to do the editing, but you probably will go down as the longest episode to date. So congratulations on that.
You got to cut it down and get rid of the boring parts. And
no, yeah. there's just nothing boring here, man. This is awesome.
You can't have an hour. What is it? Hour and 30 minute episode.
Hey, this is my show. I can have whatever I want.
How long are your episodes typically?
Between 20 minutes and an hour. Some of them have, the longest I think was like an hour and 30. And we're an hour and 42. So we should probably wrap this up because we're still recording.
I can't believe. You know what? That means I talk too much.
No. Well, you know what? Here's the thing. You're relevant. And that's the thing. You're a good storyteller. You have a good voice. And it makes sense. You're not like pulling stories out of, well, my uncle one time. It's where did your uncle come from? Like, he wasn't, how's that relevant to you and to what we're talking about?
That's true. I'm going to tell you my next metaphor that has nothing to do with me.
Sweet. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. Okay. Great. You're so personable.
Man, I can't wait to talk to you again.
You get it, man. You've been doing this long enough.
Well, Paul, take care.
Hey, man. It's good talking with you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.
Hey Dreamers, Joe here. I really appreciate you listening to Dreamers Podcast. If you'd like to find out how to support the show, please visit howtodream.co/support for all the ways you can help out. Thanks for the support, and please keep on dreaming.